Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, it's Friday at 7 o'clock. Welcome to Little Atoms. I'm Padraig Reedy, and my co-host tonight is Neil Denny, and our guest is Bruce Hood, and I'll hand over to Neil straight away to introduce Bruce.
Thanks, Padraig. Bruce Hood is currently the director of the Bristol Cognitive Development Centre in the Experimental Psychology Department at the University of Bristol. He has been a research fellow at Cambridge University and University College London, a visiting scientist at MIT, and a faculty professor at Harvard. The author of Supersense, and most recently The Self-Illusion, which we're going to be talking about in tonight's show. Bruce also presented the 2011 Royal Institution Christmas Lectures. So Bruce, welcome back to Little Atoms, first of all.
Welcome back, guys. Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here.
So we're going to be talking about The Self-Illusion. Now, this book gets off with an absolutely cracking line, which is, one of the strangest experiences we can have is to hold a human brain in our hands for the first time. So I want to spend the first part of the show talking about the brain, but we may as well talk about it, you know, quite literally. What's it look like? What's a brain look like, feel like?
It depends on what state of preparation is. If it's one that's just been newly delivered, as it were, of course, it's a bit squishy. But most brains that medical students deal with are, of course, treated and preserved in formalin, and so they have the resemblance of a kind of a hard cheese, kind of grayish in matter. Of course, when you cut through it, it has all these different laminations in it. But it's like a very firm kind of cheese, and that's because it's been set in formalin.
It must feel quite awe-inspiring to be holding another person's brain. You talk about that in the book, about that feeling of holding something that's had, you know, a person's whole life basically filtered through it.
Exactly. I mean, it was one of my when I came over from the States and arrived at Bristol, I had all these ideas for new ways of teaching. And what I had experienced in the States was the power of just, you know, looking at real brain. Now, you know, in my field, psychology, the link between actual structure and function is always a bit elusive. Nevertheless, I think it's a very valuable exercise to look at a human brain in its raw state and just be confronted with the sheer complexity of what you're trying to unravel. Because, you know, there are no box diagrams, there's no arrows in the brain. You know, it really does look like one big homogeneous mass to some extent. And yet, we know that it does have all these abilities and separate functions, and these can be selectively knocked out. And so there's a lot of hidden function and structure. So that's why I think it was so powerful, is just to sort of see this as a, you know, the vesicle of who we are.
So how much do we know about the brain? Well, essentially, what goes where? I mean, you hear stories about you know, people's right side of the brain being knocked out and left side of the brain being knocked out and different functions disappearing. But how much can we tell from what we know so far about what actually, you know, is there a place where memory is stored? Is there a place where motor functions are stored?
Well, yes. I mean, and, you know, you have to be quite careful. It's not like a Lego model. So it's not put together in that kind of very simplified way. It's a massively parallel system. So there's a lot of information flowing backwards and forwards between all the various areas of it. But there is a degree of specialization. So the back of your brain is the visual area. And if you get a whack on the back of the head, that's why you see stars. The temporal lobes are the language areas. So if you get a, you know, a tumor there, you might lose language. The top of your brain is the motor area. If you put a direct current there, you can make people's arms twitch. And the front part of your brain is the prefrontal cortex, and those are the areas which are dampened down by alcohol and various types of drugs, and a whack on the head there will make you disinhibited and behave in very antisocial ways, or very social ways, depending on how you are.
Slightly deeper than that, there's a diagram in the book of this idea of the brain as like the metaphor of an onion, the different layers.
That's right.
Let's talk about those sort of like the, you know, the core and then the sort of outward layers and what they are. And because there's this interesting idea that they, I guess, evolved over time. You know, the central part of the brain is the oldest part of the brain.
Yeah, and this is actually something which is out there in kind of common notions. They talk about reptilian brains. Unfortunately, there's a little bit simplistic. I mean, they do not exist independently of all the other structures. But yes, if you think about it, the vital functions are basically controlled by what we call the brainstem. And if that gets damaged, then you're basically screwed. That's when your brain dead, is when your brainstem is damaged. And that controls your heart rate, it controls your breathing, all those vital functions, a lot of the reflexes. above that, in very general terms, you have a set of systems that we call the limbic systems. And these are the systems which control your arousal, you know, gets you up in the morning, controls your sleep-wake cycles and that. That's connected to the long-term memory systems, the hippocampus that goes into the temporal lobes. So these are all what we call the subcortical systems. They're all below the cortex. The cortex is that outer layer. And it's actually only, you know, the thinnest layer on the outside, which is about 3 to 4 millimeters thick. That's where you find the dense packing of all these specialized cells, which we call the neurons. So it's the neurons. And the nature of a neuron is that it can encode information when connected with lots of other neurons. That's where all the higher order processing is going on. But, of course, there's a continual flow of information backwards and forwards between the lower centers, which are running, if you like, automatically to a certain extent, and the cortical structures, which is where we think a lot of consciousness must emerge. So when your cortex is knocked out, that's when you lose consciousness. Mm-hmm. But the cortex is basically, you know, relaying information backwards and forwards up and down these centers and horizontally as well. So it's massively parallel. You know, it's difficult to talk about them in isolation. Although we're tempted to do so, we must remember that it is this degree of parallel processing.
And we often talk about the that sort of limbic system, the so-called reptile brain, as you said, about, you know, sort of controlling instincts and desires. And often that, you know, there's a massive debate goes on to the extent at which those things are controllable and those sort of things are natural. But below that, and this had never really occurred to me before until I read the book, but the deeper system than that, we have absolutely no control over. You know, I cannot control my heart or my blood circulation or things like that.
You can't stop yourself breathing. That's why these reflexes are, well, they're there, they evolved to keep you alive, but of course they run totally automatically, yes.
So I want to move us on to talking about, you know, neurons and the idea of the connections and the, you know, the way that the brain works through those various connections. But are those really, really deep systems just not connected to the rest of the brain, I guess? Why is it that I can't control my breathing, but I can...
Oh, because you don't need to and you don't want to. You don't want to have a system which is dependent on that kind of voluntary control. That would be a daft way.
I wouldn't be able to get sleep.
I mean, evolution generally, natural selection just doesn't usually produce these dead-end results. They're there for a good reason. And you don't need to have sort of top-down control. I mean, you can regulate your breathing, and you can, you know, you can engage in behaviors which will have which will reduce your heart rate and so on. I'm not saying you can't control them indirectly, but no, these fairly are autonomous systems. And by the way, there are other parts of the body which have control, like in the gut.
There is this gut brain. Yeah,
I haven't talked about it in the book at all. But yes, of course, the nervous system isn't all in one place. Mm-hmm. It's distributed across the whole of the body, and basically the brain is just this central resource which, you know, takes all this information and regulates it to some extent. So I think that's the way I think about the brain. And the neurons, their functional structure and the way that they're connected together, that's the secret processing power of the brain, is it enables vast amounts of information to be stored across networks as distributed information. So if you think about your iPhone, or if you think about any computer language, the strength and power of computing is based on an idea called information theory, which is that any complex pattern, doesn't matter how complex it is, can be broken down into simple binary information. And that's the basis for every computer language. And binary information being on or off is effectively what neurons are doing. But they're doing it in a very complex way. They're not doing it in a simple on and off. They're doing it in each neuron, if you like, is a little bit like a microprocessor because it has up to 10,000 connections and there's 86 billion neurons. And you can understand when you start to do the computations, they are vastly interconnected.
Let's talk about then how the brain develops in a child. So, you know, a baby is born. How much of a baby's cognition is genetic, already programmed within it? How much then does it go on to learn? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question. And I think that's been one area where there's been massive changes in the past 10 years, the way that we think about it. And actually, you know, up until about 20 years ago, it used to be thought that babies didn't have any functioning cortex. Mm-hmm. They're basically little subcortical little animals. We now know that that's not true. The cortex is not up to speed, but it's not that it's not functioning. Babies are generally born, in terms of evolutionary terms, are born about 3 months prematurely. And one of the reasons we think that's occurred is because as our heads have expanded, you know, to incorporate a larger and larger brain, there's been pressure to try and deliver the baby earlier. Because when we evolved to stand upright, the pelvic canal couldn't get any bigger, otherwise you'd be waddling like a duck. So the solution was really to give birth to earlier babies. So they're immature cortically, but the cortex is still functioning. But around about 2 to 3 months, it really comes up to speed, okay? It really hits the ground running. And most parents will tell you that their 2 to 3 month old is a completely different species than the thing they gave birth to. Because now they're social, they're smiling, they're interactive, they're really just completely much more exciting creature to deal with.
So how much of that stuff, you know, how much of that was pre-programmed?
Okay, they're not blank slates.
Sure.
Without a doubt. I mean, they're not blank slates for a good reason. First of all, you can't build structure with a blank slate. You have to have some rules. So anyone who works in programming will tell you that. You know, you can pick up structure from the environment, but you still have to have rules built in to know what the structures are that you're looking for. So we believe that there are rudiments of information stored genetically that you're born with. For example, just the layout of the sensory system, you know, the way that you perceive the world, that is already organized retinotopically, okay? So the way that your neurons are actually placed in your visual cortex do have a correspondence with the real world. But what the real world does is it then fine-tunes that. So we know from lots of work, from animal work, I hate to say it, but also from human studies, that you do need environmental input to tune up what is the basic building blocks of it. But what is wired in, of course, is exactly the sort of areas where we're arguing and disagreeing about things. I mean, people think that language has a good candidate for being genetic because, you know, you can't teach any other animal to speak and it has these characteristics, it's universal. And so language is one that has been thought for a long time to be definitely an instinct. Steven Pinker talks about it, you know, building on Chomsky's work. But even then, people will argue about it. So this is where the really interesting debates are going on. You know, what is wired in? How much is acquired? How much can you alter?
As we begin the second half of the show, we'll get on to the concept of the self. But I want to introduce the idea of... We talked about neurons. Let's talk about the idea of mirror neurons, which you talk in the book. And what are they and what are their significance?
Well, mirror neurons offered the promise of a very simple engineering solution as to how we can empathize. And the original idea comes from was work done with monkeys. And they discover that when monkeys observe someone making an action, the part of their brain which also controls actions fires in response as if they were making the action themselves. So it was the idea was that this would be a direct connection with watching other people do things, so you could empathize. And very grand theories and very grand claims were made for it. Ramachandran, a famous neuropsych, said this was almost the equivalent of finding the structure of DNA in neuroscience. I think that's probably an overstatement. I mean, it turns out that the idea that mirror neurons do represent a completely sort of unique type of cell is under question. They're not the majority of cells in the motor cortex. And even then, they may acquire that characteristic through learning. See, the point was that if they were built in from the start, there wouldn't need to be any learning. But I don't think that's ever been shown because basically we've never done the developmental studies. They've never studied mirror neurons in babies, for example. So whilst in principle, it sounds like a really easy solution as to how we could mimic and copy each other without having to learn it and truth, I think it's not going to actually deliver those promises.
It's probably, as I'm saying, it sounds like an incredibly stupid question, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. Is there any identifiable structural physical change in the brain as the person, and I said we're going to get onto the self, as the person goes from this apparently premature thing and develops an identity? What difference actually occurs observably in the brain?
Okay, so that's a good question. We do know, for example, the brain of a newborn weighs about a quarter of the weight of an adult, but within about a year, half of that difference is made up. And that difference is really mostly due to myelinization. Myelinization is like the lagging you get on your hot water pipe or the insulation you find in your electrical wiring. Okay, so it's fatty tissue. And it's basically insulating the connecting fibers between the neurons. So there are two general processes going on. There's what we call a generative set of processes. So the neurons are starting to wire up together. They're starting to form these connections, these synapses, which is the connections between the neurons, and they're undergoing myelinization, which is strengthening them. And that process is really driven by experience. So those cells which are firing together wire together. Okay. Yeah. Now, we think this is a process by which the environment can shape and encourage those connections. So in other words, you're born with the potential for lots of potential connections, but the ones you end up having are the ones which are shaped and triggered by the environment. And the flip side of that is the second set of processes, which are degenerative, and that is the loss of those connections if you don't get that firing. So use them or lose them. So this process of strengthening those connections and also losing the ones which are not being reinforced is the way that we become tuned in to the environment. But that process seems to be limited to the basic fundamentals of the human mind. So it's language, faces, those things which are really important to us. Because obviously you still learn a lot of information through your life. And every time you learn something, that is stored as a pattern of connectivity, a pattern of strengthening between the neurons. So you don't want to have that degenerative process always going on. Mm-hmm. You need to have this sort of ability to always keep forming these connections. And so the big question is, do we have the same degree of plasticity as we get older? And I think there's evidence that we do in some of our domains, but other ones we seem to lose that capacity. And that's why I think it's harder to learn to ski or harder to acquire second languages once you've gone through what is called the sensitive period. So a lot of this wiring, this shaping, seems to have these windows of opportunity.
You're listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and Padraig Reedy, and we're talking to Professor Bruce Hood about his book, The Self-Illusion, which is subtitled Why There Is No You Inside Your Head, and we're going to talk about that bit as we're going to the second half of the show now. So, Bruce, this idea of a self, the idea that there is a you inside our head, is something that we all know, we all recognise. It seems really obvious. But I've sort of found it very difficult to try and conceptualise that into a question, never mind write a book about it. Right. So let's talk about where this idea comes from, because obviously, as the book is subtitled, we're going to get to the idea that this thing doesn't really exist. It's an illusion.
Yeah, okay. So this is something which, when my publishers asked me to write an idea for a book, I'd made a statement in my first book talking about the logical nature of arguing about free will, that there's someone inside your head making decisions. And they said, can you expand upon that? And so this is where the book came from. And I suppose what I'm attacking in the book is this common sense notion that you are an integrated, coherent individual inhabiting your body, almost like a puppet master controlling it. I mean, every time you look in the mirror, you see your face changing, you see your outward appearance changing, but you still feel continuity internally. And that's what I was trying to address. So you can talk about the self in different ways. If I said to you, do you like chocolate ice cream? You have an experience of hearing me ask you a question. You have an experience of considering it and then formulating an answer. That's what we call consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that's the experience of self in the immediate. That's the I experience of being I. But of course, that decision is based on all your experiences in the past of having different ice creams. And that's really all to do with personal events. So that's the me, that's the personal identity. And if I was to say, tell me about yourself, you'd be able to say, I was born and I was born in wherever and I have this job. And so you're able to describe this character who has this consciousness at the moment, but also a history. But both of those, I would argue, are characterizations. So I would say that the experience of a unified consciousness is the output of a multitude of unconscious processes which produce this coherence. And I'd also argue that the sense of personal identity is, again, a narrative constructed by your brain to make sense of who Neil is. And we put these together, and we know this is the case because, of course, both can fractionate in under various conditions, either through the influence of drugs or the effects of brain damage or even dementia. People say, when they've got people who encounter relatives who are undergoing dementia, they're really shocked at the deconstruction of personality. So I argue that neuropsychology tells us that the experience we have must be the output of a multitude of systems. And that's what I mean. There's no individual as such.
If anyone is wondering, I'm actually indifferent to chocolate ice cream. So you just mentioned this multitude of different influences. My next question was going to be, how do we develop these selves? Let's talk about where this self comes from. Obviously, it obviously develops as we get older and we endure more and more experiences and witness more and more things and meet more and more people. Mm. So let's talk about how that develops.
Okay, so I mean, try and imagine yourself to be a baby, if you can, which of course I've made an argument in the book that you can't, because you can never have the experience of an infant with an adult's perspective. Mm-hmm. And if you had the infant's perspective, then you wouldn't be able to make any sense of it, if you understand. So, but anyway, you're not born when nobody can remember what it was like. Well, very few people can remember what it was like before their second birthday. They have these images, they have these stories, and of course there's people who will give you, they'll say they can remember being born. But frankly, that seems to be, there's not a good evidence for that. So a baby, I think, has the experience of I. So I think they see the consequences of their willed actions and they have that. I doubt they have a personal identity of who they are, where they're going, and what they're going to become. Clearly, as they start to become more socialized and understand the world around them, they start to adopt those aspects or facets of their persona. So they will, for example, consider themselves either male or female, mm-hmm. or they might consider them a brother or a sibling. And so they will start to construct a sense of personal identity. And that's driven initially, I think, very much as an egocentric perspective as a very young child, that all these big adults around there looking after me, and if I wail, they'll bring me food. But then, of course, as a child, it has to then enter into a much more complex set of social engagements and dealings, entering in with siblings and then going to play groups. Then they have to learn a set of skills to be able to communicate. And that then starts to formulate and shape. So they start to become self-conscious, they become self-aware, they become aware of other people's perspectives around about 3 years of age. Children start to understand that other people don't necessarily see the world the way they do. And then, of course, through middle childhood is this preoccupation of where you are in the pecking order, and then you enter into adolescence, and then you want to distance yourself from your parents, and you become much more influenced by peer pressure, peer groups. And that's why it's a difficult time, because, you know, you're trying to formulate an identity, and that identity is a reflection of what other people think about you. And then you enter out of adolescence into early adulthood, and I think you end up in your parents in your mid-20s or 30s anyway. So, you know, the genes win out in the end anyway. But there's good evidence that actually, you know, there is these stages of how we conceptualize who we are.
That level, I'm just reminded of the film that did the experiment with the trying to raise a chimp as a
Nim,
child.
Nim, yes. Yeah.
And there seems to be a sense, at least from what I know, that process almost went to a certain extent. You know, it did happen that there was some sense of identity. I mean, how much does this manifest itself in, well, in other apes, really?
Okay, and again, this is a contentious issue. The question is, do they have a theory of mind? Theory of mind is a technical term, which means that you can understand that other people can have mental states which are not necessarily the same as your own. You can attribute and see their perspective. Without a theory of mind, you'd just be treating them as automatons to some extent. It used to be thought that theory of mind was uniquely human. I'm no longer convinced by that. I think there's good evidence that actually other higher primates can do this as well, because they can do things like deception. Mm-hmm. And deception is this capacity to mislead another person, and obviously to steal mates or food. And I think there's good evidence that other certainly chimps and the apes can do it, and I would imagine possibly some of the monkeys. But it's a gradation; it's not either or. It seems to be a thing. There is some claims that dogs can do it. I'm not convinced by those arguments. I think dogs just seem very like they can do it. But
it's more us projecting this.
I think we anthropomorphize them as well. So no, I think certainly we are very skilled at, and without that ability, of course, then you have individuals with varying degrees of autism that, you know, they simply cannot understand someone else's perspective. And without that, it's very difficult to have human interactions. It's very difficult.
Staying with the apes, but going back to, you know, how you talked about how our self-image develops, there's a great image in the book about about chimps being actually more developed than gorillas, because chimps are social animals. Gorillas tend to spend most of their time in solitary behaviour.
I asked Robin Dunbar about that, and I asked some primatologists about it. It was really a reflection of the extent to which they live in groups. And so mammals which live in groups tend to have more of these social skills. So dolphins, various aquatic mammals, are much more, give evidence of theory of mind. So they have mirror recognition. They have much more self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And indeed, actually, at the basic neurophysiology level, there are these specialized neurons, the spindle neurons called the von Eckermann ones, which have been found only in those species which are social. So the argument is that maybe gorillas, I'm not saying that gorillas don't have any theory in mind, they're just not as sociable as other primates which live in larger groups.
The point, I guess, that this book is heading towards is the concept of free will, and if we're talking about whether or not that we have a self, you know, we have a definitive you inside us, to what extent can we really be said to have free will at all?
Well, I don't believe in free will, although I don't believe you can ever get rid of it. Free will, there are different ways of thinking about it, but it's the idea that you could do otherwise. You know, given a whole set of circumstances, you could make the choice. But that, to me, invokes this homunculus, this individual, this Solomon inside our head, sitting there making judgments. But then, of course, who's inside their head, and their head, and their head, and so forth. So I find the notion that there can be some arbitrator, this individual inside your head, just doesn't make sense. And even then, where are they? What are they basing their decisions on? We don't have the freedom to choose all of the experiences which basically shape our decisions. So there's some logical arguments, and there's some sort of neurophysiology arguments about why there can't be a center of free will.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I've always found this concept difficult. I mean, and the clash between, I mean, obviously the innate self is an odd belief, but at the same time, I don't quite understand the argument of the complete negation of free will, because if I go to a restaurant and make a choice, I could have made another choice, or is the genuine argument that I couldn't?
Well, the argument is actually you could have made another choice, but that choice has already been made for you, because that was what was fed up from all the unconscious processes which led you to your decision. So that's the point. I think that the decision is happening before you're aware of it, is what I'm saying. So you certainly have the feeling that you're making a choice, but actually a lot of that decision has already been made for you based on all the unconscious processes and experiences that led you to that awareness. Now, you're probably aware of the Libet experiments. I don't hang everything on that argument. And for the listeners, the Libet experiment is basically the finding that if you have if you tell someone they can push a button whenever they want to, you can measure quite reliably that the decision has already been made before they're consciously aware that they're making the decision. So I think that that makes a lot of sense to me from a neurophysiological position, that you do have to do a whole lot of preparation, processing of information, that then the output of that then becomes our decision. But if you think about it, all those computations, all those experiences, to some extent, are already pre-formulated before you make the decision. So that's what I'm saying is the illusion.
Isn't that still your brain making that decision, but you only becoming aware that you made that decision a millisecond later, and that's when you sort of, oh, I made this decision, but I did make that decision, it was a lower level of
Yes, yeah, you could look at that as well, but that's not the conception people have. Generally, people don't think like that. They say, actually, I can change my mind anytime I want, and that's fine, and that's the way it should be. And therefore, of course, it's very adaptive to think like that, because that's how we have culpability and responsibility. And if we start going into this really deep issue about, you know, where, at what point was a decision made, and if you remove the person from that process, then you get into a very sort of sticky water. But of course, we do know that people are not necessarily in control of their decisions. You only have to have tumors in various parts of your brain. We know that alcohol can change the whole thing.
You talk about instances where, you know, people have, you know, their behavior has changed radically because of a brain tumor, for instance.
And we're quite happy to say that they're not responsible, because a tumor seems to be some sort of alien invasion of their body. But of course, a tumor is their own cells. They just start growing in a different way. So, you know, it's a very interesting perspective. And indeed, in the States now, they're starting to investigate this whole idea of culpability and free will by turning to the neurophysiology, trying to show that someone is not responsible. But that's a non-starter.
We're out of time. We could have carried on talking about that for ages if we'd, well, you know, we could have. We thought we were making the decision to talk about it for ages, but obviously it's someone else is making the decision for us.
It was the homunculus sitting behind the control desk.
The numbskulls are making that decision for us. So we've been talking to Bruce Hood about his book, The Self-Illusion, Why There Is No You Inside Your Head. Bruce, thank you so much for coming in and talking to Little Atoms again today.
Thank you, guys. Great to be back.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.